The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Joseph Michael, and you're listening to Talking Metal.
You're listening to the Talking Metal Podcast with your host, Mark Striegel, and special guest co-host, Victor M. Ruiz. iTunes number one hard rock and metal podcast. I'm Bud Friendly. Now, here are your hosts, Mark and Victor.
Welcome, one and all, to another edition of Talking Metal Live. This is Victor M. Ruiz over in Spain, and all the way from the East Coast, Mr. Mark Striegel. Mark, how are you?
Good, Victor. Victor, it's been a while since I've spoken with you. Glad to be spending another Friday night hanging out with you live on the Talking Metal stream on Live 365. The way you listen to that is you download the Live 365 app to your phone, your iPad, and you search Talking Metal within it, and we come right up. You can also listen on Live365.com if you're on a PC or a MacBook or something.
Excellent.
So, we got a special guest. You want to tell us who we're going to be talking to tonight, Victor?
Sure. We're going to be talking to Joseph Michael, former lead singer of White Wizard. At least that's how I not came in contact with him, but first heard his voice and first heard of him as an artist. And I think the majority of us is the same deal.
Yeah, definitely. I don't really know much of what he did before White Wizard. It's something we could ask him about tonight, and we can find out what he's up to now. We did play a track on the last episode of Talking Metal by a band, which I mispronounced. I said Omery Rising. It's Amory Rising, I believe. And I played a track by them on the last episode of Talking Metal, which he is singing on. I don't know what the deal is behind this band, if he's just a guest on the recording or if he's actually a member of the band. Do you know anything?
I know nothing whatsoever on the subject. Hopefully he can shed some light and let us know what's going on with his contribution to this band and what else he has going on at the moment.
What else is going on tonight, Victor? We got a lot of stuff happening in the world of hard rock and heavy metal.
Sure. We have an interesting tidbit that came out. I thought it was a April Fool's joke, but it turns out that Duff McKagan is doing some South American dates with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, and he's already done a number of them. Frank Farrar just posted this awesome picture on his Facebook of him and Duff, like, you know, hanging out together. And I mean, I have tickets to go see them in Pennsylvania, which hopefully we have a hotel room and everything lined up, but there's a slight chance I might be traveling for work and I won't be able to go, but hopefully it won't fall on that day. And I tell you, I would just love to see Duff with Guns N' Roses as opposed to Tommy Stinson.
Yeah, that would be really cool. What's amazed me is that he's doing a lot of the new material as well, so there seems to be no issues whatsoever with him doing the Chinese Democracy songs.
Yeah, I mean, I even saw they were doing a Bumblefoot Abnormal. Yeah. They were playing. I don't know if they're playing that as a full band or Bumble's doing it acoustic or what, but I saw that in the set list. Duff does a Misfits song. What, you're the Misfits expert. What song was it? Do you know?
Attitude, which is off of the Spaghetti Incident. They've actually covered it plenty in the past.
Okay. Very good. I should have known that. Wow. That's awesome. That's awesome.
And they actually do Abnormal as part of his solo. So the entire band minus Axel usually do that song live.
Ah, I gotcha. Cool, cool. Well, I think it's an exciting time for Guns fans to have those two guys back on stage together playing full concerts. You know, there was that time over in London or whatever it was that Duff jumped on stage with them for a bunch of songs. And later he said he regretted it, that he had done it. And I'm not sure if that's because it just got so much press or Slash gave him shit about it or what. But it is interesting to think about how Duff doing a string of dates with Guns N' Roses would make Slash feel. And I would imagine that Slash wouldn't feel good about it. But who knows? Who knows? It's only speculation. And I also wonder if this is him testing the waters for something more major with Guns N' Roses. I mean, could he be testing it to see, hey, you know, could I do this again? I mean, let's face it. I would think Velvet Revolver is pretty much dead at this point. I mean, you know, no one really cares. You know, it's like no one, right. There's no real want for another Velvet Revolver record. Is there?
I don't think there is. I mean, you know, we've gone through all this drama with them looking for a singer. They finally had, and I almost just had Stapp, Scott Weiland as a singer, went through that whole debacle. And, you know, I think if they couldn't make it work with him, who else could they get that would even get them remotely close to the same? Scott Weiland could have gotten them. And let's face it, you know, for a lot of people that complain about whatever Axel's done with the name or whatever has transpired, similar to the whole Kiss situation, Velvet Revolver, with all of these original members of Guns N' Roses, can come close to meeting the type of, how do I phrase this? The type of billing that Guns N' Roses got with this current lineup. They were still headlining festivals around the world, headlining tours, where Velvet Revolver, at the most, if I'm not mistaken, was opening up for Aerosmith, which is what Slash is doing now. So it comes back to, you know, greater than the parts, and the name actually just putting them over the top. That Guns N' Roses brand just draws people in, where Velvet Revolver and Slash and Miles Kennedy and whatever, although they have their little niche and they're doing great on their own, it just isn't at that same level.
Yeah, you know, with Slash, it's interesting because I feel like Slash has more of a recognizable name just as frickin' Slash than he does with Velvet Revolver.
Yeah. Right. I agree. They're doing much more, they're doing shows that are, how do I want to say this, like more top billing shows where they're getting more exposure. That's the word I'm looking for. They're getting more exposure as Slash, and his material is getting out there more, I think, than anything that he's done in Velvet Revolver. Because let's be honest, with Velvet Revolver, they had, what, maybe 2-3 songs on the radio? Whereas with his project with Miles Kennedy and with Fergie and with everyone else that was involved, he's had quite a few different tracks played on the radio. And this also isn't his first foray on his own. He did Snake Pit, and that pretty much fell apart rather quickly as well. So he sort of found something that, you know, works for him. And let's be honest, with him as top billing, he's also going to – he doesn't have to share the same amount of spotlight or money in the end that he does with having Matt Sorum or having Duff on board with the band or – you know, well-known lead singer like they did with Velvet Revolver.
Yeah, yeah. So it should be interesting to see what happens. Again, I'm all for Duff ending up in that band, and I think there's actually members of that band who would like to see that too. Just from little bits I've heard. Haven't been in contact with anybody in that band in recent time, but you know, there's Bumblefoot, it's no secret that he's friends with Duff too, you know. I mean, he right. got up on stage and played with Duff, and Axl's never had that hatred towards Duff, you know, and you know, it would just be great. It would be great to get Duff back in the band. I would love that.
And it would also, I think, bring a certain sense of legitimacy to the band that maybe people have questioned. Well, you know, it isn't only Axl anymore, and it is Duff, who has played with so many people over the years, who's jumped in and decided to, you know, revisit what he had done in the past. But I do think that, you know, even if it's only two out of the four big names that were in the band, they're actually three big names if you really look at it. It's still, you know, a good chunk of what people recognize with that band.
Absolutely. And on that note, let's get into a little Guns N' Roses here on the live stream. And when we come back, we will hopefully have Joseph Michael, formerly of White Wizard, on the line to update us on what he is currently up to.
Excellent. This is a track that Duff wrote. This is It's So Easy off of Appetite for Destruction.
I see your sister in a Sunday dress. She's out to please, she pounds her best. She's out to take, no need to try. She's ready to make. It's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me, baby. It's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me. Cars are crashing every night. I drink and drive, everything's in sight. I make the fire, but I miss the firefight. I hit the bullseye every night. Now it's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me, baby. Yeah, it's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me.
So easy, nothing seems to please me. It all feels so right when I fade into the night. See me hit you, you fall down.
I see you standing there. You think you're so cool. Why don't you just if that's what you do, turn around, bitch, I got a use for you. Besides, you ain't got nothing better to do. And I'm bored. It's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me, baby. It's so easy, easy, when everybody's trying to please me.
So easy, but nothing seems to
speaking.
Hey Joseph, this is Victor and Mark.
Yo.
From Talking hey. Metal Live. You are actually live right now.
Really?
Warned, yes.
Cool. Oh my
Joseph,
god.
Great to have you on. You're live on the Talking Metal stream with us right now, but most people will hear this in podcast form on Tuesday. But mm-hmm. we have had so many people on the show from White Wizard, former members of White Wizard through the years, and you are one who we haven't spoken with yet, so welcome, and we're ready to
thanks
talk
for having
to you.
Me.
You bet.
There's been a lot of members to choose from over the years.
Yeah, like 34 or something. I don't know.
Something was quite like that. Yeah.
It's in the 20s, I think, right, Victor?
Well, that officially, yeah. There's more, but they didn't get yeah.
There are more that never even got officially into the band that were just touring members, and there are a bunch I'm sure we don't even know about.
Wow. Right.
Well, anyways, we loved your voice on the last White Wizard record, and we wanted
Thank
to find
you.
Out what that voice is going to be up to nowadays that you're no longer involved with that band.
Well, I mean, that's if it is a band anymore, but
yeah, that's a whole
yeah, actually, yeah, that's not my fight no longer. As soon as I got back from Europe, while I was still in Europe, was still with Jake and Will down in southern England, Jake asked me if I'd like to write a record with him, and you know, that didn't then everything went down with the band, and you know, everyone jumped ship, and I got back from Europe, and Jake's like, "You still interested?" And we've been working nonstop since November.
Wow! Now, is this what you've sent me? You have had some MP3s sent to me by help me with the pronunciation, but Amory Rising.
Amory Rising is
Amory Rising. Okay.
Yeah, I guess it's like some Norse god, but
That's not with Jake.
No. That's some guys up in Fresno that were having some trouble with their singer. They were in the middle of recording like an EP, and they approached me asking me if I'd do it. And you know, I do this. This is my thing. I do this for a living. So they hired me to sing on this, and they were able to get me and Ralph Patlin, you know, packaged together. And so I went down to Arizona and did a couple songs with them. That's what that thing is. It's just a guest spot so that they could move forward because they were having a lot of trouble with the last singer.
Gotcha. So the thing with Jake, is there mm-hmm. a name for this yet?
I was speaking with him yesterday, and we don't want to release the name until we get all the trademark clearances and the band agreement, you know, nailed down. But yeah, like with the EP is written, and we're due in to start tracking the actual what will be the actual EP in July, because everyone's schedule. We have Ralph Patlin, who's going to be involved, and we have Adam Sagan from Circle to Circle, who's going to play drums, and you know, everybody's busy, so July is when we're going to start actually tracking.
Cool. And are all you guys based in Los Angeles?
No, Adam's in the northern Midwest, like Minnesota. But yeah, Jake and I are in LA.
And it's going to be an EP, which means like what, 4 or 5 songs?
6 songs.
Excellent.
6 songs, about 40 minutes of music. I mean, we could be cheap and call it a record, but we're not going to do that.
Okay. And stylistically, what can we expect? I mean, we know you and Jake again from that last White Wizard record, which is, you know, traditional straight ahead metal, I would call it.
Right. It's definitely different from what you heard on that record. I mean, we are pretty much given a template to work within, being a White Wizard, and you know, we really couldn't divert too much from what the fans of that band were used to hearing. So whatever we wrote in that project had to be kind of, you know, filtered. But this is a lot more dynamic. It's a lot more a lot darker. I would say like along the lines of Nevermore, King Diamond, but with
okay.
some like theatrical, like Sabotage, Pink Floyd elements.
Oh, cool.
yeah, it's I'm really happy with the songs that we have for this, and it really took me by surprise, you know, like after that big European fail, letdown, that we were able to just pick right back up and move forward.
But you mentioned Jake had asked you about writing a record with him when White Wizard was in Europe together. Was this prior to the demise of the band?
I mean, we really don't want to talk too much about White Wizard. I know that right now, like, that's what you guys want to talk about. Put it bluntly, White Wizard was doomed from the start. I mean, how many talented musicians can you go through and expect to keep getting chances, you know?
Right.
The tour wasn't even going to happen. There were some things that were told to us before we got on the plane that as soon as we got off the plane weren't lined up, and you know, it was a miracle we got through, you know, the six shows that we did as a unit. We were at Will Wallner's mother's house, and we were discussing, you know, things like rental cars and where Jake's money was and the Indiegogo funds, and that's when that all came about. And it was the next day in Cardiff that I basically told John, you know, look, you know, where's the money? If not, I'm out. Like, I'm out. And then that's when I was no longer in the band.
Okay. So this is a four-piece that you guys, the project, the band with Jake?
Not too sure. Right. Okay. We're going to be looking for probably a second guitar player and a bass player. So it'll probably end up being a five-piece, maybe keyboards. They're not that big of a part of the songs right now, but I've been writing some things here and there, mostly for atmosphere transitions.
When you say atmosphere and transitions, you mean like in between song stuff?
That too. Yeah. I don't know how well you guys know me, but I play a variety of instruments and write and whatnot. And yeah, and it's going to be pretty dense.
And do you produce too? I seem to remember reading you do producing, right?
Yeah. I write, produce, do all that, play guitar, bass, piano.
As far as the stuff that you've recorded previously, off of the Devil's Coat, would you ever entertain playing any of that stuff live with what you're currently going to be playing?
I don't think that will happen. I can't see it happening. It's not really my call.
Yeah. Cool. And are you guys talking with labels? Or is it too premature, being that you haven't started recording yet?
Obviously, Earache asked me what I was doing as soon as they found out, you know, that White Wizard was done. I mean, I was still in Europe, and I'm getting messages from them like, "Are you in the band?" No. Okay. Then, like, the next day, White Wizard no longer on Earache, and they're asking me to call them when I get back. Yeah. So there's some interest. I'm sure once we get some of the recording done, where we can have something to show. It's too early though.
Okay. And will you guys converge as a band in one specific studio, or being that members are kind of spread out, will each person kind of be recording their parts in their part of the country and then, you know, pulling up?
Well, no, we're talking with Ralph, Devil's Cut producer, about tracking everything with him in Arizona. So everyone's going to be in the same room.
cool.
Yeah. I think we might actually go out to Minneapolis and work with Adam on some of the final arrangement touches.
Excellent. And what were you up to before you were in White Wizard? Can you fill us in on a little bit of your past and background as a musician?
Sure. Well, the last thing I did before White Wizard, I was working on a group of songs for, we called it Vixens, Volume 1, and it was like 10 female singers and 10 different styles, and we produced this thing in my studio. I played guitar, bass, sang backgrounds, engineered some of the sessions, and one of those songs ended up on Fright Night 2, besides White Wizard, one of the other things I've done that had some notoriety.
Yeah.
Before that, I was in a kind of like a niche band called Midnight Rain, where I pretty much played everything on it, sang, wrote everything. But that was a self-release, and I could never find musicians that could fulfill it,
Right.
But I mean, I've been doing music full time for, like 13 years.
So you're able to support yourself just strictly doing music?
Oh yeah. Yeah. For the last 8 years. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Doing lessons. Right. Yeah. It was a hard fought battle. I mean, I moved out to LA from New York on a Greyhound with $50 in my pocket in 99. And, it was an uphill battle.
Yeah. Cool. And where in New York are you from?
Upstate, Utica, near Syracuse.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I got a cousin in Sodus, Sodus.
Where is that? Is that by Binghamton?
Actually, that's closer to Rochester, so yeah, not too close to Syracuse.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, my first concert was in Rochester.
And what was that?
That was Aerosmith and Brother Kane. Like 1992. Yeah. It didn't last very long.
What are some of your favorite bands of all time? Singers.
Favorite bands. Singers. The singer that got me into, because I started as a musician playing guitar and a little piano, but the Skid Row record, Slave to the Grind, was one of the first things that made me want to, give it a go. That and Dream Theater's Awake, Sabotage, Dead Winter Dead, definitely King Diamond Conspiracy was a big one.
Good ones.
Yeah. I like a lot of, my tastes run pretty wide.
What non-hard rock stuff do you listen to?
Can I talk about that?
Oh, of course.
I mean, everybody likes certain Prince songs. I like some country, like Ted Rogers.
Cool.
Definitely classical music. I like a lot of the singers. I'm a definite fan of Mariah Carey, Celine Dion. Things like that.
Okay. And so you now live, do you live in Hollywood?
I have a place in Silver Lake, and I have a place in Las Vegas.
Oh, okay. Now, Silver Lake, where actually is that?
Silver Lake is a little bit east of Hollywood. It's right in between like Glendale and Los Angeles, Hollywood. It's next to Dodger Stadium.
Oh, okay. And how would you describe the scene, both scenes actually? How does the scene in Los Angeles, music scene, specifically hard rock, heavy metal scene, compare to the music, hard rock, heavy metal scene in Vegas? Because we've seen so many hard rockers kind of end up in Vegas in recent years. So I'm just wondering if you can compare the two or talk about the two.
Well, it's weird. Like without sounding jaded, it's hard to be honest. But I didn't even know there was a metal scene until I got asked to join White Wizard. Really, I didn't know that there was like a whole clique of bands, like Holy Grail and another band, Gypsy Hawk, and I didn't know that these bands existed, and let alone that they had, you know, fan bases. It's like this massive void of emptiness. That's what both LA and Vegas seem to be like.
Okay. Cool.
Like, unless you know about these specific bands, like if you just show up at any of the venues on any given night, 99% of the time there will be no one in there.
But is it almost like a click that once you're in, that the scene actually does kind of exist and, you know, it's maybe thriving
totally.
On some level?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of support there if you're inside. Like I couldn't believe some of the bands like that we had on some of those White Wizard tours that were the opening bands. I mean, they had a lot of support. And I would presume that it's, you know, a collective of all the small bands in that scene, you know, showing up.
Yeah, based on what you're saying, I guess Adam would be a perfect drummer to fit the bill to do something in the Pink Floyd Sabotage vein. Is that the specific reason that you wanted to go after him to fill out the band?
Jake's worked with him before. They did a I don't know if you'd call it an EP. It's only three songs, but Jake has a solo record out. It's kind of like, you know, the shrapnel, like shreddy prog thing. And Adam played drums on that, so that's how they know each other. So I think that he was already going to be a part of it, no matter like who he was working with.
Basically, Jake was comfortable working with him and just wanted to bring him into the fold?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. I mean, he's a great drummer. I don't know if you've heard his other work. I think he was in Into Eternity and his other band he was in. But, yeah, I mean, the guy can... He can definitely write for a melody, and he also can... He can shred.
Gotcha. Okay.
Cool. Well, Joseph, I think it's pretty exciting news to have you and Jake working together in a band, and I hope you keep us updated on stuff like recording and the band name and what you guys are going to be up to, you know, touring-wise and stuff like that. It sounds like a very promising start.
Definitely, yes. We're everything's going to happen at its own pace, and we're going to be really measured about what gets released and what doesn't and when.
Cool. Any word from Will? You spoken with Will Wallner lately?
I talk to Will all the time. I spoke with him the other day. We had a good laugh over some nonsense. He's enjoying his time in Berlin, I guess.
So there's no chance with him being in Berlin that he could be pulled in as the second guitar player.
You know, I don't know. I'm not sure if this is Will's cup of tea. We did a video on with Carilla from San Diego Metal, and where we talk about our favorite King Diamond albums, and Will like had nothing to say.
All right. Well, I guess we're gonna. What do you have queued up there, Victor?
I have a track called Road to Sleepy Hollow by Omari Rising. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
I think so.
Omari, right? Omari Rising?
It might be. I haven't clarified that with them.
Okay, well, let's get into a little Road to Sleepy Hollow then.
Cool. Thanks, Joseph.
No, thank you, guys. I'll let you know as soon as anything can be announced.
Yeah, definitely. And we can get you and Jake back on at the same time if you want.
Actually, that sounds great.
Cool. All right, take care.
All right, guys. Thanks for having me. Have a good night.
Bye.
Let the sun melt your eyes. Lady Snow wants only a mind. She will take you away from this place. We'll be right back.
We are back live here. Mark Striegel, Victor Ruiz. We just had a little...
Joseph Michael.
Joseph Michael. We'll keep it at that since...
He was like, I know that all you guys want to talk about is White Wizard. It's like, well, all right. What do you want to talk about? Well, he made a big announcement. And that is he's working with Jake. A lot of stuff going on. We mentioned Duff and Guns N' Roses. Very exciting. We also should mention the Kiss Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes. Yeah, got to see the... not the induction ceremony, I'm sorry. The speeches that the four original members made.
Yes.
And I thought they were, you know, they were good for the most part. I know that a few people online wrote that they didn't agree with what Gene had said or whatever. But, I mean, I thought Gene did a good job, named all the, former members that they wanted to acknowledge as well. And, I mean, I had no issues with more or less what everyone said. I thought they did what they needed to. And, I thought it was good.
I mean, I think, you know, there was one of these speeches. It was like a handheld, you know, cell phone cam or something that was up on YouTube. You know, it didn't sound like there were massive boos when Stanley mentioned Kulik and some of the other members, but I don't know if those boos were directed towards him, which if they were, that fucking sucks, man, because Bruce Kulik is the fucking man who kept that band alive, you know, and was not single-handedly, but was a part of keeping that band alive in some very important times, for us hardcore Kiss fans, not even the hardcore Kiss fans. I mean, just the casual Kiss fans of the mid to late 80s and the first half of the 90s. I mean, Kulik was such an important part, and he should definitely have his name mentioned from the stage by Paul Stanley, Gene Simmons. I mean, I would have thought it would have been freaking cool if Ace would have said his name, but, you know,
right.
Because Ace and Kulik are friends, you know, but it's like that didn't happen. So, you know, I think maybe those, I don't know, did he, I think Paul mentioned Bruce, Tommy, and Eric Singer, and Eric Carr, and all in the, kind of in the same breath. And I don't hope, but I could see that those boos were maybe directed towards Tommy, you think? I don't know. What was your thought on that? I just thought it was kind of uncalled for because, listen, the Hall inducted the four members, and they're standing by that. So why is it... a problem for Paul or Gene to mention the members that didn't get inducted?
Well, here's the thing. I agree with you 100%. And I've said this over the last few weeks. Does the Kiss reunion mean as much if Kiss doesn't carry on with Bruce and with Eric Carr all those years? You know, does it just become like a Bay City Rollers type reunion where, you know, it just doesn't have the same meaning? I think what those guys did for, you know, as you're saying, the Kiss fan, not only the hardcore Kiss fan, but the casual Kiss fan that came along when Lick It Up came out, when, you know, Crazy Nights came out, and whatever other albums, you know, were coming out at the time. I think it's, you know, their place in the band is very important. The only thing that I could think of, that since it was with a cell phone, maybe they were saying Bruce and it came across as boo.
Yeah,
you know,
could be.
No, I'm hoping it was that, you know.
It could because be. It could be. I'm gonna have to go back and listen. That's a good point because I remember when my dad used to take me to see the Yankees back in the late 70s, early 80s, and Lou Piniella would come out. Everybody would go, Lou. And I'd be like, Dad, why are they booing him? And he would be like, no, they're saying Lou. So maybe they're saying Bruce, but who knows? However, the speeches themselves, and I don't want to spend a heck of a lot of time talking about this, but here's my rundown of the speeches. Before I do that, by the way, if you want to see a picture of John in a tuxedo at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it is on our Twitter, twitter.com/talkingmetal. John was there with Ace. He's been with Ace pretty much 24/7 since Ace has been in town. He's probably with him right this minute, actually, until Ace leaves on Sunday to go back to San Diego or whenever it is. But anyways, the speeches, I thought Gene, this is just real quickly, I thought Gene, from the YouTube, you know, footage I saw, which it's going to look and sound a lot better when it's on HBO next month, but from the YouTube footage I saw, I thought Gene sounded nervous, actually. I don't usually see that in Gene, but I thought there was a nervous tone to his voice and almost like a nervousness up on stage. Even when he first yelled, it was like a little weird, like it was like, all right, or whatever he said. I thought he legitimately seemed a little nervous, which with all the celebrities and stuff that were there, maybe he was, you know, or maybe not. I don't know. But it was the vibe I got from Gene's speech. I thought Gene's speech was nice, and he was very respectful of Ace and Peter, almost going a little overboard, you know, with his praise of Ace's guitar sound. And I shouldn't say overboard, but, you know, he really expressed how special he thought Ace and Peter's, you know, drumming, guitar playing, and singing, for that matter, were. You know, he even acknowledged Peter Criss's singing were to the you know, early part of Kiss. And I thought Peter's speech, I can't really remember it that much. I do remember that he thanked Sean Delaney and Bill O'Coin, which I don't think Gene had. Gene went first. So I thought that was cool from Peter. I thought Ace's speech was good. I think he also thanked Bill O'Coin. I found it interesting. He thanked his ex-wife or his wife he actually still may be married to and hasn't divorced, but, you know, he has a fiance. Maybe they are divorced at this point. I don't know what that deal is, but yeah, he thanked Jeanette, and I would expect him to thank his daughter, and he thanked his beautiful current fiance Rachel. By the way, did you hear that Eddie Trunk interview? John's like on the Eddie Trunk show with Ace, and at one point Eddie Trunk's like, give John the mic if he's going to be talking. And yeah, that was pretty wild. If you haven't heard that, guys, that's from last Monday on Sirius Satellite Radio. Ace and John in the studio. Ace revealed he has written a song with John for the new record. So now John has written Ace's book and is also writing his music. So there you go. I actually think I know the riff. I'll tell you guys some other time. But Ace's speech was good. The thing I found interesting, which I almost thought was a little dig at some of the stuff that Paul and Gene have said about Ace in interviews, was his statement on addiction and how it's not a choice. It's a disease. It's, you know, I forget what he said, something about diarrhea or something. But,
yeah,
you know,
willpower, that if willpower really mattered, that you would have the willpower to stop diarrhea or something to that effect.
Yeah, and whether you believe that or not, listen, I don't consider myself an addict. I don't weigh 400 pounds. I've done drugs and I do drink, but I've never had an addiction problem. You know, I don't drink every day, and, you know, do I like to get a buzz on? Sure. But I don't know what it means to be an addict. Part of me feels like it is a choice, and I don't know if I agree with what Ace said, but Ace, you know, how I feel about it is regardless. Ace made a point to say that this is not a choice to be an addict, and he feels it was something you were born with, something you can't control, and that is something that I feel was aimed at a lot of things that have been said in recent years about him in interviews with Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I was listening to it and thought the same exact thing. And I was looking, because you could see Paul right behind him, I was waiting for the reaction, and you could see Paul was like shaking his head during parts of the things that
I think he was like, when Ace said about the diarrhea thing, Paul made kind of like a little laugh or like shook his head a little bit, you know, but I really feel that statement from Ace was probably directed back at some of the comments that have been made about him recently. And hell, what do I know? Maybe, you know, I listen, there's genetics. They say different types of people, alcohol and drugs affect different people differently, depending on their genetic makeup, depending on just who they are as a person, depending on the way they were mentally brought up, you know. So maybe he's right. You know, I'm thinking it through right now. I guess my thought has always been that stuff like that is a personal choice you make, and I very well might not have a way to understand it, and I just might not be educated enough. So maybe Ace was correct about that. Whether he's right or wrong, I do feel like that comment was directed at some of the stuff that has been said about him in public. Paul's acceptance speech, and then I'll let you talk about your feelings on the stuff, I thought was good. I thought Paul was good, and he kind of stuck it to the Hall of Fame a little bit, which I thought was great, and I'm very curious to see if that part gets edited out of the HBO broadcast, because in the past, these induction speeches, when HBO airs it, have been cut down. I think Steven Adler even complained about his being cut down. They definitely get cut down, so, you know, if they're going to cut something down, I could easily see them saying, edit that thing Paul said out. Although maybe they'll let the guy, you know, have his say on HBO. Who knows? What did you think of the whole induction?
I agree with you with Gene. I thought he was crying, to be honest with you. He just seemed like very nervous, or like you said, or just very emotional, very overwhelmed with the whole thing. And I didn't think of the whole thing of having, you know, like Jimmy Page and people like that in front of him shaking him, because you see him, you know, flapping his gums at all times with all the various interviews and different things where he appears, you know, with all these like paparazzi type
interviews. But imagine like Jimmy Page and all these, like Bruce Springsteen, all these heavies like in the fucking audience while you're up there, and especially a band like Kiss that just never got that love from the critics or the press. I could honestly see it. I mean, I listen, when I was in bands, like when I was playing to people I didn't know or people who were fans of my band, all five of them, you know, I was never nervous. However, when I was in a room where suddenly there were, I remember once I was in a room and a bunch of the guys from Bon Jovi were at the club while I was playing, and not John Bon Jovi, but a lot of the other guys. And I got real nervous, you know. And another gig I played, you know, extra, some of the guys from Skid Row were at that gig, and I got nervous just because they were guys that, you know, were big rock stars and that I had maybe looked up to a little bit, and it was intimidating in a way. And you know, if it were a bunch of guys like Tom Morello and the younger generation that worship Kiss, I bet Eugene wouldn't have been nervous at all. But I could see like people like even like Jimmy Page, who seems to be friendly with the Kiss guys, but I've never heard him say like, oh, they're the most amazing group ever or anything. You know, I don't know if he respects them artistically. I think he respects them as individuals, and maybe he does. I don't know what Jimmy Page thinks, but I just, you know, it's just, I could see it being a heavy moment for Gene and the other guys.
Yeah. With the Peter speech, the only thing that sort of stood out to me was he made a point to say, well, I'm the, something to the effect of, I'm the one and only Catman or something like that.
That's right. That's right. You're right. He did say that. He did. I'll always be the Catman. I'm the one and only Catman. I'll always be the Catman. And that was absolutely a slam at the fact that they're still using his, you know, his makeup, which, you know, is no longer his. And
yeah.
I'm, you know what, on a whole nother note, and I got to talk to John about this to find out the real deal, but this comment Ace made about that the rights to the makeup revert back to him sometime soon, so that should be interesting.
Yeah. If it's true, and that's funny, I posted this online. I said, well, for everyone that's, you know, bashing Tommy and Eric, if Ace decides to rent the makeup back out or whatever, then, you know, no one can really complain about it because he's fully involved in the whole thing. The other thing that people seem to forget also is that both Ace was in the band with Eric and Peter was in the band with Tommy, and neither one of them complained at the time. So
yeah, but if I mean, in Peter's book, I don't think Peter ever got along with Tommy. I mean, and there was very brief thing where they were in the band together for that Aerosmith tour, and that right. I really don't even think they wanted Peter in the band for that tour. When I say they, I mean Paul and Gene. They were under tremendous pressure, and this is coming from Peter's book, but they were under tremendous pressure to tour with the original lineup. Aerosmith did not want to tour with Tommy Thayer and Eric Singer. Again, this is Peter's story. They wanted to have the original four there, and there's even a thing in Peter's book where Joe Perry called Peter and like tried to, you know, say, you know, what's up with Ace? You guys got to get Ace, and you got to do this tour and stuff, and it may even have influenced Peter's decision to do that tour. So, but yeah, you're right. They were in the band, and Peter says he didn't like even looking over at Tommy, you know. So, and he made it sound like they didn't really get along well while they were in the band together.
Right. I know that in one of the interviews that were done before the Hall of Fame with it was either Guitar World or I don't believe it was the Rolling Stone. It was either Guitar World or Classic Rock Magazine, where Tommy actually goes out and says, you know, I'm more than just the former tour manager. You know, I've been in the music industry for 30 years now.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, the Guitar Magazine or whatever that was with Paul and Gene on the cover. Yeah.
Yeah. As far as Paul's Paul's speech, once I was done listening to it, it was funny. I went to eat lunch with my wife, and it was the first thing that I said there. I said, well, it'll be interesting to see how much of this speech actually makes it into the final show that's on HBO, because he, you know, he's been hammering away at the Hall of Fame the whole time, and he, you know, did it once again, and I think he's 100% correct. You know, for years and years, you know, you've had, and not to knock any of the people that were, you know, inducted previously, but, you know, did the Staples sisters or whatever their name are, you know, did they have more of an effect on music overall than Kiss did, or than Sabbath, who took forever to get in, or even Zeppelin, who didn't get in on a first try? You know, I mean, it's
Deep Purple, who's still not in, you know.
Still not in, yeah. So, I mean, he's 100% right. And you see that they turned it over to the fans for three different occasions. Rush got in, Kiss got in, and Nirvana got in. I mean, Nirvana would have gotten in anyway, but it's just interesting that, you know, the fans are actually voting for harder-edged bands. They're definitely not voting for Patti Smith or anything, you know, remotely similar to that. And no knock on Patti Smith, but does she have the influence that, you know, Purple or Yes or Maiden or Priest has had?
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous. And I think it was cool.
I think, yeah, go ahead. Finish.
No, I was going to say, I think it was cool to see Tom Morello's speech. I don't know if you saw the press conference where Tom came out and then Ace came out. Ace with John, actually. And Tom made it a point.
No, I didn't see the press conference. John was at the press conference.
Yeah, Ace couldn't hear a lot of the questions. So John was running out on stage and he was repeating the questions in Ace's ear so he could repeat. And I mean, Ace was up there making Ace noises, basically. So, yeah.
It's so amazing to me that John, this lifelong friend of mine who I've known for, you know, oh, I don't know, going on 25 years, you know, he has always just been, he's always known Ace, even when I first met him. But the fact that he's now working for Ace is really crazy, but good for him, you know. So he's having fun doing it, and Ace treats him well, you know. Ace seems like a good boss, and hopefully we'll be talking to Ace soon on Talking Metal. It sounds like that's going to happen shortly.
Awesome. Getting back to the whole Tom Morello thing, he basically says this, is that he was championing for Kiss to get in for quite a few years now. And he's been after the Hall saying, look, you know, you guys are neglecting hard rock and metal, which is a very important part of rock music and has helped keep rock music alive for, you know, a few decades now. And you're really turning your back to them. And their bands, he says, a band like Kiss should have gotten in on the first, you know, year they were eligible. And he basically says, you know, thanks to the fan voting now, he says, who knows what will happen next year? He said, but, you know, within the next few years, I'd fully expect, you know, Deep Purple, Iron Maiden, and Judas Priest to be in the Hall of Fame. He says something to that effect.
Yeah.
So I thought it was cool that, you know, that he goes out and mentions all this.
The problem that Deep Purple have, and I love Deep Purple, and I think they're as influential as Black Sabbath on what heavy metal became. But the problem Deep Purple have that, you know, Kiss and Rush don't have is Kiss and Rush have today, at this point in their career, have a much stronger diehard fan base, where Purple have a very small diehard fan base. You know, great band and really amazing stories and a lot of just crazy stuff when you look at their history with who's been in and out of that band, but they just don't have that emotional connection with as many people that Kiss and Rush have, and, you know, Sabbath have for that matter too. You know, they just don't have it. And I would say Iron Maiden have that connection with their fans more so than Purple does nowadays. I mean, Iron Maiden, when they come through New Jersey, they still basically fill or close to sell out, you know, the arena in Newark, where Deep Purple are coming through, hoping to check them out, actually. And they're playing, you know, the little theater in Morristown.
Right.
Which, you know, I don't know what that... Have you ever been to that place? Probably seats 1,000. I'm not sure. Maybe more than that. 1,500, maybe.
Between 1,000 and 1,500.
Yeah, it sounds right. And they'll probably do pretty well filling that, but... It's not, I mean, Kiss, you know, people make a big to-do about, oh, Kiss can't sell out arenas like they used to, but they do really well when they come through town, right, at least through New Jersey, especially when it's a double bill with Motley Crue or Def Leppard or something like that. So I think that's the one issue Purple will have, is they don't have that devoted fan base that Rush and Kiss have. At least not right now in 2014. And they don't have the critics on their side either. So it'll be tough. And, you know, if people like Lars Ulrich and other people can petition and maybe get the board to recognize them. Or, I mean, who the hell's on the board? Aren't these guys getting to be like 70, 80 years old? They should be dying off soon. And I do think that the next generation of hipsters, which is essentially what these old guys on the board at least were back in the 60s and 70s. I do think among the newer generation, like I even heard the current editor at Rolling Stone is a big Kiss fan. You know, I do think the music press, the let's say 50 and under music press is much more accepting and respects bands like Kiss and just hard rock in general a lot more than the over 50
or even over 60 crowd does, you know?
Right. Well, I think that, and I've said this for a while now, they're definitely going to have a hard time filling the hall, because if you're going to neglect a lot of what took place in the 80s, I mean, if you look at it, not only are the bands that we mentioned, do they need to go in, but Motley Crue has to go in at some point. Whether you like it or not, Bon Jovi and Poison have to go in at one point. All these bands were huge at one point in time or another, and their influence was felt for good or for worse, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, just those people on the board, they just hate those bands. So until there starts to be some turnover, you're only going to get a handful of these bands. I mean, Bon Jovi, honestly, they have that diehard fan base. You know, they still are able to have like some of the top grossing tours of the year when they go out. You know, and yeah. So I would see Bon Jovi being if they're eligible, which they should be. I mean, when did the first record come out? That was 82, 83.
They're well past being eligible.
So I would see Bon Jovi as maybe one of the next ones, honestly.
I mean, I think what they're going to have to end up doing is like taking one band from the 80s and one band from the 90s just to pacify people, similar to what ended up happening with Kiss and Nirvana. Not because that was done by, you know, obviously, again, the fans voted for them. But I think you'll see something like that where, you know, you'll get a Judas Priest or a Maiden along with a Smashing Pumpkins or something along those lines, just to sort of keep everyone happy, because I think they've done enough to this point to piss people off. And, I mean, if you look at it, had they have named the place the Music Hall of Fame, none of this would be an issue. And, you know, they could have inducted, you know, a rock act one year, a rap act, a pop act, and there wouldn't have ever been an issue. But once you put, you know, a certain style, you know, attached to the museum, you know, I don't see how, again, a lot of these folk singers fit into,
right,
you know, that, or even Madonna.
Yeah,
or,
if you call it the Music Hall of Fame, then you got it. Just there's jazz and there's freaking classical, and maybe Popular Music Hall of Fame would have been a better
term.
Then you're not going to have to induct Yo-Yo Ma and all these guys. But
right. What did you think of the whole Nirvana thing? With
I haven't seen all that much of it. I think it's cool. Courtney and Dave hugged on stage. Saw a small clip of Joan Jett singing Teen Spirit, which I didn't think sounded terrible, and I didn't think sounded amazing. My friend who was there told me that the Nirvana stuff with Lord and the chick from St. Vincent were just incredible. So I look forward to seeing those. I didn't see the induction speeches. I'll probably wait to watch those when they're on HBO.
Why isn't this stuff released on DVD, though? I've been wondering that for years.
It's probably, you know, it's rights and clearances stuff. I don't know.
But don't you think they'd make enough money that they'd be able to, you know, take care of all of that?
I don't know. I really don't know.
Or maybe there really isn't a market for, I'm assuming, again, as you just said, with like Kiss or Rush, where you still have a big fan base, you know, you could potentially sell these things, but maybe other years.
I don't know. And then, so what happened also, I guess, just to wrap up our Hall of Fame coverage.
Sure.
Ace had mentioned, and John had even told me this, that he was going to jam with Tom Morello. Now that was cut, right?
I don't know. What little information that I've seen was on Blabbermouth and Brave Words, and it was early this morning, and it was just the induction speeches and the two interviews that I mentioned. I didn't see anything regarding whether Ace ended up playing or not.
Ace was supposed to play Highway to Hell, probably,
right,
because they you know, Paul and Gene wouldn't give him publishing rights to do anything else. Acid, I guess, offered to do New York Groove, and that was shot down. I don't know if that's a different publisher since, you know, Russ Ballard wrote it. Yeah, so he was going to do Highway to Hell, which I just think is a little weird. Okay, you're going to do an AC/DC song. It's kind of strange. Right. Have AC/DC been inducted?
Yes.
They haven't?
Yeah. That was, I mean, they had their issues with that as well. So they,
well, anyways, they were supposed to do Highway to Hell, and I heard that it was cut. I'm not 100% on that, but I heard that because Springsteen's speech went too long, it was cut. So let's wrap it up here tonight, Victor. You got anything you want to play for us to take us out, or not? We could just end it.
Actually, I had some Vinnie Vincent queued up.
Oh, yes. Vinnie Vincent. There was a great article on the Rolling Stone website about Vinnie, and of course, sounds like he's not in that house in Nashville, the Nashville suburbs anymore, and no one seems to know where he is. People are thinking maybe even he's back in Connecticut. Any guesses to Vinny's whereabouts?
I guess Donnie G, a.k.a. Bill Wang, will have to spread that search a little farther than
The searching the parks in San Francisco is not going to turn up Vinnie Vincent. At least I don't think so. You never know, though, right? You never know.
They did confirm that his wife did die, though. It was interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that she was a former girlfriend of Ace Frehley.
Yeah, I asked John about that, actually. And John said that's what people think. But this John, just recently I asked him, and John said, I don't actually know that that's true. And John knows more about Ace than Ace knows about himself. So there you go. If John doesn't know that it's true, so I who knows? Who knows? Maybe it was she had a one night stand with Ace or something. Maybe not. I really don't know. I don't know.
Could be.
Maybe it's not true because not everything you read or see on the internet is the truth.
Right. Regardless of what people think.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, it's been great hooking up with you again tonight.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm going to try to post two Talking Metal episodes next week, this being one, and my interview with a couple of the people from Epica as another. So hopefully a twofer, right? That's how they used to say it. A twofer of Talking Metal will be hitting you next week in podcast form.
Awesome. So I have a little Vinnie Vincent queued up. This is coming off of the Euphoria CD, which is mentioned in the article. And this is a track called Wild Child coming off of that.
And when did this Euphoria CD come out?
96. I picked it up when he did the signing at the Teaneck Kiss Expo.
And did you get him to sign it?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So you've met Vinnie Vincent.
I've met Vinnie Vincent, and it's funny because the person that I was dating at the time was studying photography, and for some fucking reason, when she took my picture with Vinnie Vincent, my head's cut off, so it could be anyone.
All right.
So, and yes.
Did you guys break up after that?
No.
I would have broke up with her. You freaking take a picture of me and Vinnie Vincent and you cut my head off? That would have ended the relationship.
I wasn't thinking clearly, sir. he was escorted to the signing booth by a bunch of bodyguards, which I found funny.
Yeah.
But which is also mentioned. The next year he did show up without bodyguards, but
yeah.
Anyway.
His obsessed fans. He can only sell 12 t-shirts, you know, for $75. But, you know, he's worried about the obsessed fans. Jesus. Craziness. Anyways, I'd love to see him resurface. You know, it would be we got to ask Mitch LaFon about Vinny's whereabouts. He seems to be so connected. He's got to have some thoughts on that issue.
A Canadian connection.
Yes.
He's got to have something from the Canadian underground that's at least given him an inkling of where Vinnie may be located.
Yes. So, guys, check Victor out on Talking Metal Digital's Mars Attacks podcast. Check out Mitch LaFont on One to One, another Talking Metal Digital podcast. Of course, I'm Mark Striegel from Talking Metal. John joins me a lot here on the podcast. You guys all know John Astronomy. And sometimes we do another podcast called Talking Rock. That gets about 3 episodes a year, so don't hold your breath for that one. I have another one mapped out, though, so I'm going to hopefully do that soon. But anyways, it's been great talking with you tonight, Victor. Let's end with a little Vinnie Vincent.